When we last left our heroes, they were locked into a terribly important discussion. Let's drop in on them again as they plot the future. Now, from the Top Dog's Kennel in beautiful downtown Burbank, it's the Terrence and Phillip Show.
Once again, thank you, Gary. Welcome to the Terrence and Phillip Show. I'm Terrence Curran.
And I'm Phillip Hudgetts.
And today we're going to talk about...
Well, we're going to take from the starting point an article that I saw called... Hollywood and the Jobs Crisis. It's the headline, and the subhead is from one post-production vendor, all our business models went out the window.
You know, article I could completely relate to.
Yeah. I think the first observation I make is that business models are always going out the window.
Well, that's true.
You know, new business models come, old ones go out.
Yeah.
People tend to hold onto the old models way too long and not adapt to the new ones. MMPAA. Never heard of them.
And yeah.
Always known to be great adapters, those folks. No, in fact, Hollywood has always been against any new technology.
Yes.
So just to deviate before we get back to that.
Well, wait, except for 3D.
Except for 3D. They keep coming back to that.
Yeah.
And that's not technology that the audience really is ranking for.
Exactly.
That's it. In fact, this Protect IP / SOPA legislation that's going through the various House and Senate at the moment, my take on that is because the MPAA and IRAA are for it,
it's
got to be bad for them.
Yeah.
Because everything, you know, they were against the VCR.
Oh, yes, that's
and
true.
That would, that, you know, that's two-thirds of the industry's income comes from home entertainment. The division that they would have had removed from their future had they had their way in the Betamax case. So I think anything that the MPAA or IRAA are for, we should, for the sake of the MPAA, the studios and the record companies, we should oppose it because it's not good for them. It's always not good for them what they want. They're so incapable of knowing their own good future. However, and that's just in the context of they are not adapting their business models. And that's really what the big problem that they're having is they're simply trying to force old business models to be maintained. And
well,
we
it's,
can't
you know,
do
it's,
that.
It's difficult. The larger the company, the harder it is to move rapidly and to adopt new models, et cetera, the more entrenched they become in the way they're
working.
Which
is why the entrenched tend to be replaced by the new rather than be...
Right.
You know, very few big companies manage to reinvent themselves sufficiently.
Yeah, it takes something extreme like, a manic person like Steve Jobs to be able to turn a company around. And now that he's gone, I wouldn't expect to continue that way for long.
Well,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, a couple of years. But this is a...
Yeah,
an anonymous...
they have a roadmap now for the... Yeah. But you know, I don't think you're going to see some major new...
No, I mean... He was a unique talent, and unique talents tend to drive, you know, Jack Dorsey, Square, and Twitter. He's another in the same mold that keeps finding new ways of communicating, finding new ways of doing things that break the old model. I mean, Square, with credit card payments on your phone,
right,
on your smartphone, that's genius. And they're now doing something like $2 million a day.
Wow.
There's somebody else that's trying to do a similar thing for web APIs for online. It's still in a closed beta, but...
Mm-hmm.
So there's constantly new business models being formed and new people lead into that. And it's rare that the big companies adapt. I don't expect the studios to adapt. I expect the studios
change,
and the networks to die long term. Not tomorrow, not 2010, not 2015, not 2020, but eventually their business model will die.
Yes.
Because they will fail to adapt.
But back to the Post article. You
know, yeah.
The article about Post.
Yes, and it's an anonymous speaker.
Yeah, you know,
the
speaker's
a veteran of 3 decades of various facets of the entertainment industry, an independent vendor for post-production services. They identified him as Larry, and which apparently is not his name. But
no, I have some ideas on who it may be. But there's, you know, there's certainly plenty of people that fit into that category. But yeah, it's the upshot of the article is the industry has changed. Everything selling posts now is about how low can you go, you know, to beat the other guys who are selling it. It's no longer about relationships or the quality or the material, you know, the gear that you have, et cetera. And that is a big part of it now. And it's, you know, the reason that we've seen a lot of larger post houses go away in the last few years.
And, you know, that's the reason that you started
Alpha
Dogs, is because you saw this trend coming, that the bigger post house was not viable long term.
No, it's, yeah, exactly. But, you know, so now the question is going forward, where do we go from here? And it really is now about from my opinion, it's about the talent and developing the desire in the client for that talent. That's really what it's all about. Because you can't base it on any kind of gear anymore.
No, everybody can own the gear. And I think the industry did itself a huge disservice for about 15 or 20 years where it sold toys.
Yes.
I have a Betamax. I have not, you know, not Super VHS. I have a kaleidoscope or something. Yeah. You know, I can do two.
We have the Chiron.
Then, I mean, I saw it in the 90s where the prosumer, the home tools, could do things that I couldn't do. You know, they were using all sorts of trickery. You know, technically, it was a bad video signal that really wasn't up to spec for broadcast, but it did stuff that I couldn't do for 20 times the price.
Right.
And I sort of say, okay, this is going to migrate. This is the direction we're going to go. So selling tools, selling toys, whatever camera I might have, whatever gear I might edit, is irrelevant. It's about the product. And I realized that no other industry sold the tools of their trade.
Right.
You know, what hammer brand gun brand did somebody work?
Music, you know. You sell the guitar, you sell the piano or something.
That's
probably true. Are tools of the trade. But it is rare. And those don't sell for, you know, I mean, you can
buy
a cheap guitar.
The cheap guitar is a commodity.
Exactly.
A high-end, I mean, a Stradivarius violin is a scarcity.
Yes, but the people who can play it or would know the difference even are a scarcity too.
Exactly. So we don't care about what brand of engine analyzer is used with our car is tuned. We don't care what brand of nail gun the carpenter uses as long as the construction is good.
Exactly.
You know, I don't care what brand.
I'm more concerned with the wood he uses.
So the whole idea of focusing on the tools, you know, I'm an avid editor, to me is such an anathema. It's so wrong to describe yourself by, you know, define yourself by the tool.
Right.
I know historically why people did that they would.
Well, in the past, you had to,
yeah.
I mean, because the old post model was, because the stuff was so expensive, you know, you had to work your way in somewhere to get the shot at even working on the gear, and you had to be really good to get that shot, and you had to be good to continue. And so it sort of, you know, created a tier. And so 10 years ago, if you were to say, I'm an avid editor, that meant you've worked professionally.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody, you know, was willing to let you work and you know,
in
on
an
the expensive gear.
Yeah.
So that carried some meaning back then. Now it doesn't mean anything. You know, at the last Editor's Lounge, the panel, you know, those guys were talking about, well, now everybody's an editor. It makes it difficult for the actual editors, because the director comes in and he's an editor. He's edited at home on his, you know, et cetera. The producer's edited, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So it's an interesting time in the business.
So at the last Editor's Lounge, B was talking about Media Composer and really laid the blame of the faster, do it all in less time, right at the doorstep of the innovation of, well, she was saying Media Composer, but, you know, really nonlinear editing in general.
Right.
Because you can do it faster. You can make the changes faster. So when you can do it in a week instead of 3 weeks, you are then expected to do it in 3 days instead of a week, and then 2 days, and can we have that this afternoon, and can you make the changes while I sit here? And
so, right.
You know, if we'd never had that nonlinear editor, we'd have still had time to think about the cut.
Well, that's a big part of it. You know, it used to be you know, you had that time when you were rewinding tape or rewinding the film or whatever. You had time to be thinking, you know, those moments in there, you know, allow you to think about what you're doing. And they go, well, wait, maybe I could try something different.
Mm-hmm.
Plus you'd see, you know, images flying by when you're rewinding stuff that or fast forwarding. And you mm-hmm. go, wait a minute, that, and, you know, trigger ideas, et cetera. Now you don't, because you just make your decisions and go. I mean, it's the next.
And a lot of the time, the decisions that you're working with somebody else's pre-deciding.
So exactly.
In the reality world, often you're going to get the pre-cut, the long cut from the string out.
Yes.
From a story editor or from an assistant producer or somebody. You don't know what you don't know. You don't
exactly.
know what you're missing out, what other alternatives were there, and more to the point, you don't have time to care.
Well, and that was the big thing they all agreed on was time. It was interesting, you know, that a feature editor, a reality show editor, an episodic TV editor, and a music video editor are all saying the same thing. There's just not enough time to do it properly anymore. Enough time to review all the footage and to really get to know it, et cetera. So that's tough.
And the thinking time, it's important to walk away from what you're doing from time to time.
Yes.
A, for your health anyway. Sitting day, guys, you know.
Yeah.
Just, and I mean, I've been down that path and just trying to drag myself back out of it and realizing that getting up and moving and being a little bit healthier makes me feel better.
Yes.
It's right at a very deep level, but you know, I was talking to somebody last night who's working on a show that's doing very well, that's working minimum 15-hour days.
Yeah.
Where's the time to contemplate?
You don't. You're just fried.
Yeah,
go home,
I see that with Greg, my coding partner. You know, he'll be right up against a brick wall, and so we'll stop and we'll go and do some shopping or we'll go for a walk just to get out of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway through the walk or the shopping, he's come up with another another approach to take. You know, and that, I see that's being very much the same as an editor who's time to just to get away from it for a moment, to walk around the
I have the same thing. My best ideas come when I'm going for a walk. So I just force myself to go out and take a walk.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was on the production buzz, Larry Jordan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and one of the questions he was asking is, well, how do you deal with, you know, because you're running a business and you have all that to deal with and everything else, and how do you deal with creative, you know, when you're hitting the wall of all this stuff? And that's what I told him. I said, you know, I just go and I take a walk, and it helps clear out stuff. But he didn't seem to get what, you know, it's like he kept going, well, no, what do you really do? I'm telling you, you know, it's, you know, I don't know. It's actually a great thing. It's just go for a walk because it helps you just get away from it and let, you know, I don't know, a different part of your brain working.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Even talking it. Talking to somebody else about it.
Yeah.
Because I think verbal and auditory goes through an entirely different part of the brain. I know when I'm trying to spell check something or check the grammar and the structure of a sentence, reading it out loud changes the perception of it. It's like, I've been really happy with this, but let me just do an out loud read for it. Mm-hmm. And, oh, no, now it just all blows.
Right.
Speaking of which, I'm experimenting with speech dictation for writing. Just started experimenting this week, but that's a whole other.
Oh, so you mean voice recognition on its side?
Okay. That's actually pretty damn good, but this is nuanced, so it requires a little bit of training.
Uh-huh.
But it seemed to recognize the training almost exactly correctly all the time. So I'm impressed so far.
It's interesting that still isn't perfected. I mean, I remember back in the 90s, early mid-90s or something on my Mac, you know, they had it was built in there. Yeah. You know?
Nuance and Google probably have the best technologies in the world. Mm-hmm. Nuance is built into all of the dictate. It's the speech recognition that powers Siri on iPhone 4S.
You know, my Android phones have,
yep,
you know, have added, you know, for a couple of years I've had that the ability to do that. And it's probably 95%, you know. Some words throw it for a loop. Sometimes you get really, you know, depending on how much noise is in the background, you get some really wacky interpretations of what you said.
Apparently Douglas Spotted Eagle has written all his books by speech recognition.
Wow.
And he says that the trick is the best results come with quality microphones and quality audio.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Adapters, converters. So, yeah, has written a lot of books. I wondered how he could be so damn productive.
Ah.
And that's how it is. It just dictates it all down.
That makes sense because it would take out a lot of the, you know, there's so much time spent in the tactical interface.
I would love for Apple to make the framework that powers Siri that's been kind of cracked. Somebody's already done that off the platform.
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of caveats. But I would love that as an official open for developers to use framework on OS X. That would just be incredible because now we can do that transcription automatically. We can then generate keywords automatically from that. And
that would be good, yeah.
Because Siri also derives a lot of meaning. So if we could tap into that meaning derivation engine as well, that would be awesome. They're not going to happen in the next couple of years, but that's,
right.
You know, that would be kind of fun. Imagine that built into Final Cut Pro 10. Finally, some sort of speech recognition there or detection. So the company has it, but
now we're getting into that. Now we're getting into that.
Automate us or outsource is going to kill us first.
Yeah, that's the next show.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to this one. So yeah, the new business models. So this is an interesting problem that, you know, we're at a point in time now where people are fighting over cost. That's, you know, the value added that we're presenting to potential customers is that we can do it cheaper than the other guys. And that is not a good business model.
That is not a good business model at all. In fact, if that's your business model, prepared to be starving and moving down market in your home, your car, and your clothing, and your children's school.
Well, and that, unfortunately, is what I see as the dominant business model in the country. And when people sit here and go, oh, we've lost the middle class in the United States, well, because that's why.
You know? Yes, if you want a middle class, you actually have to pay people.
Yes, you have to pay.
I'm sorry all you 1%ers that are, you know, job creators, which I, you know, if they're the job creators, why don't we have the jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
To balance that, when you talk about the, you know, who's the 1%? I mean, Steve Jobs is part of that 1%, certainly, you know, should he not have been able to make money? I mean, where...
No, I'm not opposed to anyone making money. What I'm opposed to is where there's such disparity between the people who actually create the value in a company and the people who lead the company.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's changed over... And this is a really rough topic here, but this, yeah, that's what's no, changed it's, over, yeah, that's what's it's, changed over
but
the
it
last
is part
30
of it.
Years.
It is part of it.
Is that disparity... happens in third world countries. You know, as a second world country or first world country, the thing that defines it is a successful middle class.
Right.
Because a successful middle class can buy the goods and services produced by these big corporations that are trying to eliminate their wages for their employees, or when they eliminate that, they eliminate their market.
Right.
Henry Ford said, you know, I pay my workers well enough
right.
so they can afford to buy a car from me. And there's a big principle there that seems to have been lost over the last couple of years with some of the biggest companies.
Well, yeah, but it came from, you know, that's the Kmartization or Walmartization of America.
Everyone went to Walmart and bought the cheap goods, and suddenly they're all made in China and the jobs were in China.
So I guess the big thing that's changed is transportation has made it feasible to do that.
Yes, yeah, and communication and bandwidth. So we can have call centers anywhere in the world. They don't have to be in the country of use,
yeah,
which is something I'm not fond of. Something in my heart sinks every time I hear a strange accent. And it's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Now I know somebody's only on script. They can't be at all helpful to me, and I might as well just terminate this conversation now because it's going nowhere.
Here's really wacky. So, for instance, Warner Brothers a couple of years ago started outsourcing stuff. They outsourced their finance is done in Poland.
Okay.
And tech support. So you're renting an office and you're having a problem getting the internet or something. You call. You end up – you're getting somebody in Poland who then transfers you to somebody in the Philippines. How weird is that? So you could be here in Burbank and have a problem in your office, and you're going to talk to somebody in Poland who's going to transfer you to somebody in the Philippines to give you the solution to your problem.
And if they need somebody on site, they'll then transfer it back to somebody local.
Yes, exactly.
It's crazy.
I know.
And this is going to lead to what we've been talking about is outsourcing editing.
Yes.
So we'll talk about that in the next show.
The next show.
Yeah. So the opportunities for post-production houses, I think, are shrinking.
Yes, I agree. I mean, there's the, you know, what's left now is the high-end finishing, DI work, if you're still going to film, 3D. Certainly is, you know, more complex and still takes some investment in higher end gear to do it properly. But above and beyond that, you know, it's not really
just
there.
Just the hiring of online high quality conform,
right?
Which was what, you know, most post houses lived on for most of their life. Is somebody else is going to do it offline. We may rent them a room and an offline bay to do that,
right?
But you know, you're going to come in here and you're going to do the online here. Well, there's no real distinction. One of my first intersections with the Avid List was when I was writing an article for Digital Media World in Australia, and that would have been 99 or 2000. It's like, this is the year of unfinished on the desktop, you know, no more offline.
Right.
You know, offline is dead. And then I put the question out to the L, and it was really interesting because the response was, well, it's not really about just the technical finishing. It's about a mindset change. Because when you're doing the offline, you're really thinking about the story, the editorial flow.
They're two different parts.
So you're going through two complete – and I came up –
It's almost a left brain, right brain thing.
Yeah. And I then did a subsequent following month article saying offline is not only dead, it's still very much alive, and coined the term multi-line.
Mm-hmm.
Because although I didn't ever go to an offline an online bay, mentally I would – when I'm doing a story, when I'm getting my first cut, all I care about is getting the story down. Audio levels can be all over the place.
Right.
The pitch can be all over the titles can be
missing
or just not even there. And then I'll go back and I'll do an audio levels pass just to focus on nothing else but keeping the levels consistent. And then I'll go back and put my titles in and then maybe my color pass. And
well, I find, you know, since I deal with boatloads of editors, I find a very sharp distinction between offline and online. And one thing that, you know, when people ask me what makes a good online editor, finishing editor, whatever you want to call it, it's an anal attention to detail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a different thing than the offline mode. It's just like you said, it's almost like writing a book. You know, there's the guy who writes the book, and then there's the editor who goes through and polishes it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's two different mindsets. So there's a value added in having that, you know.
Yeah.
The question is, you know, that it can you, in coming back to our business models, can you justify having a place dedicated to people doing that? You know, I mean, we're still successful here at Alpha Dogs. I don't know, you know, how much longer. I mean, certainly there are people making a living, you know, finishing editors making a living by going to production companies and doing the finishing there for them.
Mm-hmm.
The rooms are rarely ideal for the purposes of that.
Mm-hmm.
and they don't, you know, the production company doesn't have the advantage of having that person necessarily there all the time. So when they come somewhere to finish, like here, you know, they know they're going to finish. Mm-hmm. So they get all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted and they're ready to go to the finishing stage. When they do it in-house, they tend to think of it more as a fluid process. Mm-hmm. You know, well, we're still making changes, but we're finishing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a different universe. That's not ideal for the finishing editor either. So they're different models. We're kind of dependent upon the people caring about, you know, willing to come to a place that's going to specifically do all that, take care of the graphics, take care of the audio mixing, all of that, and that they'll be handed back a master that's technically perfect for delivery to wherever they're going. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, what we're left with now, but we can't sell the gear. Mm-hmm. You know, we can only sell the talent and that reputation for doing that properly. So,
and unfortunately, the industry overall undersold that to the point where people don't necessarily even value it.
Well, that is the big problem. You know, I think we as an industry are to blame for not educating the public of what we had.
Or even educating our clients. These people are still clients. These people still need to know that quality does have a time commitment and time cost. You know?
And the problem is the younger up-and-comings are the ones that don't know that now. You know, the older guard who grew up through it understands the value of, you know, what a colorist can do, you know, and how they can change, you know, the overall feel and just look of something. Younger people don't because they're, you know, they go to school, they shoot on whatever, their iPhone or whatever camera they have. They edit it on their laptop and then they put it up on YouTube or whatever and they think they've got a finished product. Well, they do technically have a finished product, but they don't realize how much better it could be. That's what's missing now is the education level there to let them – to get them to understand, you know, there is a difference. There's a reason that their video doesn't look like, you know.
And simply downloading the free version of Resolve Lite is not going to make the difference.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a business model that I have to say. How the heck are
they? I don't know.
They probably didn't buy DaVinci for very much money.
No. I think they got a good deal on it. They probably assumed a lot of debt or something.
Probably.
Or I don't know.
But now with the, 8.1.1 of Resolve Lite,
it's free. It's got everything.
It's got as many nodes as your GPU will support. It'll only support one GPU, but for most people, that's more than enough.
Right.
And so with connectivity to Final Cut 7, Final Cut 10, Media Composer.
Yeah, the DNX HD option is now free. They were charging $500 for that before. I don't know if that was to cover R&D or I thought it was partially licensing.
I would have thought.
But obviously it must not be licensing if they can do it free now because they're not eating that. So
no, not on a free product.
So. No. So
but it's a smart move in that the next generation of people will only think of Resolve as their color tool.
Well, and another part is – you know, if you're sitting here, you know, like in my situation, I've got all AJA gear, right?
Yeah.
So if I want to now throw Resolve on something, I got to buy a Blackmagic card.
Yep.
And since it already, you know, now works with Media Composer and everything else, it makes perfect sense that, you know, going forward, we'll be buying Blackmagic instead of AJA.
Even though,
you know, technically AJA is, you know, a better company technically for support and all that.
It certainly is, yeah.
It's not going to matter if, you know, this works with the free, you know, I've got a DaVinci free.
It also makes a Symphony a little much harder sell.
Because the advantage of the Symphony is the color correction integrated into the timeline. You know, the Avid's blown it by not updating that color corrector through the years. Mm-hmm. So it depends. If you need that the extra tools of a DaVinci, you know, base light, color, whatever – then you should go to those. But if you can get by with the Symphony color corrector, which, you know, all of reality shows you can get by with, then you save time by staying integrated within the application itself. So it just depends, you know. I mean, it's not gone, but it's certainly hard to justify. Well, and they've changed the pricing. They've brought it way down because they couldn't justify the additional cost for Symphony anymore. But this is interesting times. They're supporting DNX HD. Their little recorder now supports DNX HD. Alexa supports DNX HD. It's going to support the 444 DNX HD.
I get the feeling that someone from Avid decided that you know, all
you
this ProRes support is not helping us,
yeah.
even though you can AMA that into Media Composer. But we have our own codec that we'd rather you use. So let's go out to reach out to these manufacturers rather than...
Yeah, because it's been silly to have to deal with ProRes footage in an Avid product, you know, for a while now because it was the only way you could record things. So I think this is, you know, these are all good steps on Avid's part. I don't know if it's too little too late. We'll have to see. I mean...
There's still challenges there, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
But if you... If you're not going to sell on price, then you have to sell on your unique, you know, selling proposition.
Yes.
And what is it that makes you different from every other editor, every other post house, every other whatever? What is the thing that makes you different? So I talk about this in the new Now book.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good book, by the way. I'm plugging it for you there.
Thank you. Thank you.
<You're awesome. laughs>
But you really do. What makes me different from, you know, the other 60 editors that are at an editor's lounge?
Right.
What, you know, maybe it's that I'm the only one in a particular geographical area, but remember that could be replaced tomorrow by somebody who's simply buying a house or moving. You know, and there's nothing there that's unique. But what is it about your talent? You know, I do really great color correction. I do really great audio. I do, you know, Les Perkins is, you know, has a speciality in animation editing.
Right.
And so he gets animation gigs because he knows how to do that right. So he stands out from other people in that particular type of job. B, specialized in short form. You know, some other people specialize in reality. You've got to work out what it is that makes you different from everybody else. And if you don't know it, what makes you different, then you are only going to be able to compete on price.
Yeah.
And that's the place you don't want to compete.
Right.
I paid for a business consultant back in Australia a long time ago. We had a range of products that we had created and then we sold, which is another fabulous thing to do, folks. Find some production time, some downtime, create a product that you can sell because you can keep selling it even when you're still working. Software works like that, you know, a whole lot of other stuff. So we had these training materials. And the guy, the only piece of good advice out of it all was that he said, double the price on the training materials. And I thought, hell, okay. You know, we're fairly safe. We had the only product into a guaranteed market of 76 colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Doubled the price, added some like leader's guide and student worksheets to add the appearance of additional value.
Mm-hmm.
We only had pushback from one place. And they bought it anyway because they had to. It was the only resource. So.
Right.
But I strongly, you know.
It's nice to have a monopoly.
It's nice to have a monopoly. Monopoly is great. But find a segment. Another friend of mine did a whole bunch of stuff on DVDs for traveling. So that as you travel, the kids can watch the DVD and it talks about where you're driving and what's beside and nearby. Just to keep kids out of your hair when you're doing a drive and give them something.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah. So the idea is, one of the ideas is to own something, you know, do that idea. You know, you can't necessarily be working all the time. Whenever we had a long period of downtime, no external clients, we always produced something internally. Cost us a few dollars, but mostly it just cost us the time that we were doing nothing anyway and the equipment which was doing nothing at that point anyway. So don't ever have any downtime where you're not producing something unless you absolutely need it for your mental space, as we talked about earlier.
Yes, absolutely.
But in the meantime, if you need to finish, you should go to Alpha Dogs.
That's right. If you want to improve the look or the sound of your project, this is the place to come. And if you have something, a project you do need to output to tape or you need to capture from tape, come to Digital Service Station, digitalservicestation.com near you. And if you need any additional tools to make Final Cut Pro X work better for you, I know just the guy.
Yeah, head on over to assistedediting.com. We already have Event Manager 10 for managing the events and projects, keeping them under control. We have Project 10 to 7, which lets you go from 10 back to 7 and out to Final Cut Pro OMF export, or go out to Color, or go to Soundtrack Pro. And all the rest of the Final Cut Pro 7 XML universe, including Final Cut Server. And there are still products for Final Cut 7 out there and for Premiere Pro as well. So check them out at assistedediting.com. And until next time, do something creative with your time.
Thanks for listening.